investigation the next day. And right now, she has no clue, let alone a clear one. There are so many routes to take. She knows she needs to make a decision. She reads update reports from the team. So far, despite the brutal rapes, the beatings, the murders, he's left no evidence behind. Not a trace. The mood is downcast. Earlier, she had sat with one of the seconded detectives, going through the raft of evidence they'd reviewed for the cases from West Yorkshire. But there was nothing. "And what's this?" she'd asked, pointing to the final document. The DC had pulled it up on the screen. "It's the report from an agricultural botanist. They had the plant matter found on the body reviewed." He'd shrugged. "Guess they had budget to burn, because the one odd thing identified was a type of rare grass only found on P.T. Moorland." Kara had frowned. "And what did they do with it?"
"Nothing."
He'd looked at Kara.
"I mean, it could have been a lead. The guy could have lived in the countryside, or..."
And he'd listed the options on his fingers.
"He could have been on holiday once. He could have brought it there deliberately to throw them off track. Or it could have come from the victim."
She'd got him to write it on the board anyway. And now their best leads came from flat 214. Her gaze drops to the box of VHS tapes, still on the floor in her office. She leans down, moves them around in the box, thinking. Her stomach feels like a block of lead is inside. The tech team have already confirmed that the tapes are old. Murders unconnected to their current spate of copycats. But it brings little reassurance. She can't watch them. She just can't. But as she goes to sit up, one of them catches her eye. It's not like the others. The label is different. She picks it up. Hampshire Children's Services, RDK, DOB 310386, 1 of 2, 270296. Curiosity grabs her, and she plugs the VHS machine in again, pushing the video into the slot. To her relief, it's an office. There are toys on a table, cars, dolls, Lego bricks, and a large, hearty-looking man sitting on the right.
"Do you know why you're here, Robert?" the man asks. He has small round glasses and red cheeks. His tone is kind and encouraging. "Do you remember what happened to your father, to your uncle?"
The person he's talking to is just out of shot. Kara sees a child's hand move forward, playing with one of the toy cars.
"Can I go home?"
a subdued voice says. The man looks downcast. Kara assumes he's a social worker.
"No, I'm sorry, Robert. You won't be able to go home for a while. Do you have any other family you could go to?"
The car moves back and forth, then.
"They call me Robbie."
"Who does? Your dad?"
A pause. Kara assumes the boy must be nodding. The man on the tape scratches his forehead, then flicks through his notes.
"Robbie, can you tell me more about what we were talking about yesterday? About your dad and your uncle?"
Kara watches as the car is pushed off the table.
"You said they'd play games with you."
The man swallows visibly, his Adam's apple bouncing up and down.
"What sort of games?"
"Don't know."
The man points to the dolls in front of them. There's an action man in full army gear and a Ken doll.
"Can you show me?"
The small hands reach out and pick up the figures. Kara's mouth is dry. On the tape, the boy starts bashing the dolls together. Then he puts one on the table, while the other one is struck against it.
"Your father hit you?"
"Yes."
"And your uncle?" Quieter now.
"Yes."
The boy picks up one of the dolls, and with his other hand he slowly pulls down the action man's trousers. The man on the video has turned white. The Ken doll is faced away. Kara can't take her eyes off the small hands on the tape. Child's hands, doing a thrusting motion with these two figures. She can't think about what this represents. She just can't.
sexual abuse.
The voice comes from behind her, making her jump. Shenton stands in the doorway of her office, watching the screen. She snaps the tape off. I didn't realise you were still here, Toby.
Is this from 214?
He asks. Yes. You should go home, she starts. But Shenton takes a step forward into her office. He glances at the black screen, then rocks back on his heels, crossing his arms in front of him.
Child abuse is common in serial offenders. Sadly, despite what the media likes to portray, most killers are made rather than born.
You think that's what happened here?
It's likely. Although it's worth adding that not all victims of sexual abuse go on to abuse others themselves, and certainly a very low percentage actually become serial killers. But it's a common factor.
As he talks about this, something he clearly knows about, Kara sees how he grows in confidence, standing up straighter, his eyes brighter. Perhaps after this he should look into specialising, she thinks. Move out of general policing into forensic psychology. How's the profile coming on? She asks him.
Should be done by tomorrow. Can you send me the Zodiac crime scene photos? I don't seem to have access.
I'll do it now, Kara says, then adds, Are you okay? He looks up quickly. Shenton seems paler than usual, his skin almost translucent in the harsh overhead light. He blinks at her, then looks down at his shoes again.
I'm fine.
When this is done, we'll all get some downtime, Kara says. But her words sound insincere, even to her own ears. Appropriate help for those who need it, she finishes. He stares at her again, then turns wordlessly. She watches him go back to his desk. She wonders about her hollow statement. Appropriate help. Even if anyone actually knew what that was, when would they have the time to talk to a shrink? When would she? She opens up her email and starts sending across files. She does the same as everyone in this line of work. Put all the shitty stuff in some corner of your brain, block up the wall, and walk away. Block up the wall, she thinks, as she presses send to Shenton. And hope and pray that one day the horror never manages to break its way back through.
Chapter 47. The pain takes over Griffin's whole body. It's not just his back now. Every muscle aches. His skin itches. He can feel his heart racing. He needs to take something, anything, but he knows it will only get worse. He needs more now for it to make a difference. Driving back from the station, he considered taking a detour. He knows where the dealers hang out. He knows if he wants something, anything, to take the pain away, for a bit of hard cash, he could get it. But he's also seen the results of such a deviation. He knows where these people end up, and he doesn't want to go there. Not yet. Then he gets home, and he's there. Dr. fucking Sharma with his good hair and beautiful blemish-free skin. He remembered him from before, and here he is looking even better. Christ, even he would fuck him if he was feeling a little more on form. But at last he leaves, and Jess stays. Griffin doesn't know why, but she lies down on the bed next to him. He waits for the one solitary capsule to work. He waits for some sort of relief. Earlier that day, when Jess mentioned Mia, he felt a bolt go through him. He knew he should offer some sort of explanation, but the sudden thought of her blindsided him. For the best part of a year, very few had referred to her. People tiptoed around him, euphemistically talking about her passing. But now, with all these murders, she is everywhere. Her face in photographs, her name, back in the room. And it's good. He once thought that it would destroy him to talk about her, but it makes her feel more real. She is real. The person he loved. The person that loved him.
Mia was my wife,
he whispers to Jess in the darkened room.
We'd been married for exactly 1 year and 6 days when she was murdered.
And he starts to talk. It must have been 1 or 2 in the morning. Griffin's confused. The torch shines in his eyes, waking him up. Next to him, he feels Mia jump, her body move against his back for protection. Something hard and cold is pushed against his head.
"I have a gun," a voice hisses. "Stand up."
Griffin hesitates and the man moves. The gun is taken away, but next to him he hears Mia gasp in fear.
"I have the gun to your wife's head. Don't try anything stupid."
Spoken through clenched teeth, angry and hard. Griffin slowly raises his hands. He swings his legs out of bed, looking around him. He's wearing boxer shorts. He knows Mia's in no more than a thin nightdress. In the darkness, he can only see shadows. A figure in a ski mask standing next to his wife.
"Tie him up."
Mia comes over and he puts his hands in front of him.
"No, behind you."
He does as he's told, and he feels Mia wrap cord around his wrists. Her hands are cold. She's shaking. He holds them slightly apart, hoping to keep some give in the bindings. But after she's finished, he feels them being adjusted, pulled taut, so they dig tightly into his skin.
"What do you want?"
Griffin says.
"Take anything. Anything you want."
"Oh, I will," the voice says, muffled through his mask. "Now lie down on the floor." Griffin gets to his knees on the carpet and a hand pushes him over. He falls heavily onto his side. He's thinking, overpower him. Get the gun, punch him in the face, he's probably smaller than you. But a thought goes round and round. What about the gun? What about Mia? As if reading his mind, the man growls, "Don't move, or I'll kill her." He feels the cord being wrapped around his ankles, then his feet are pulled up behind him. Something is pushed into his mouth, fabric, maybe an item of clothing. A gag taut around his head to keep it in place. A blindfold next. He tries to move, but he's hogtied, his feet securely fastened to his wrists. He pulls again, but it only seems to make the knots tighter. He can't see, but he can still hear. Footsteps. Mia's bare feet stumbling away. He can hear whispering but can't make out what the man's saying. He guesses they're in the living room and a door closes. He can't hear anything now. His imagination goes into overdrive. Griffin struggles again. He curses for allowing himself to get into this position. But he'd been half asleep. He hadn't imagined. Imagined what? He still can't hear anything. But then, Mia's voice, pleading, begging. She's saying, "No, don't, please, no." He tries to shout, but his voice is muffled, useless. He struggles again, the cord cutting in tighter. He pushes his head against the carpet, trying to get the blindfold off, the gag, anything. He hears her screaming in pain. He hears furniture falling, glass breaking, sobbing, crying, sounds that pull his heart into pieces. Tears soak into the blindfold. Helplessly, he thrashes in anger on the carpet, listening to his wife howling his name. He can't feel his hands now. The cord has cut off the blood supply. But he still can't get free. Minutes pass, then hours. He loses track of how long he's been lying on the floor. He strains to hear what's happening in the next room. Occasionally he hears cries, a few words, whispering, then silence. Then a click, a door opening. There's someone in the room with him. He struggles again and manages somehow to get upright, resting on his knees, his hands behind him. But before he can do anything else, he feels something hard strike him on the shoulders, then in the stomach, then across his face. He tastes blood in his mouth. Nose shattered. Pain rips through his body and he falls down, but his hands come loose. He pulls them around, numb, but the blows come fast, and all he can do is try to defend himself, putting his arms up in front of him. He feels the hit to his forearms. He hears the bones break. It's agony. And still they come. To his back, to his head. Blood pours down his face, and then finally he's knocked unconscious. And everything slips away. His voice sounds unnaturally loud in the silence. He stops talking. He feels Jess move slightly, her eyes in the dark.
We'd been having strange phone calls for a few weeks. Hang-ups. Nothing at the end of the line. I'd noticed that the gate had been left open one day, but I hadn't thought anything of it.
He shakes his head, feeling the familiar shame of his failure.
I should never have let him tie me up. But he had the gun pressed to her head, and he said he would shoot Mia. But knowing what I know now, what he would do...
His voice catches. The words stick in his mouth. He clears his throat.
One shot would have been better.
One shot wouldn't have been the sadistic rape for hours. He'd read the post-mortem report. He'd seen the photographs. The broken bones. The blood. The rips and tears on her beautiful skin. The beating reducing her face to an unrecognizable mush. He feels Jess move on the bed. She rests her head on his chest and her arms go around him. Her legs intertwine with his. Griffin feels his hand shaking.
He hit me. Here.
Griffin takes Jess's hand and guides it to the side of his head. He knows there's a scar there, a ridge where the hair hasn't grown back. He swallows.
He broke both arms, here,
he says, pointing to his forearms.
Four ribs, punctured a lung, and fractured part of my L3 lumbar vertebra. I was unconscious for 2 days. I sold the house. I couldn't go back there. I got suspended from work for being a detective who couldn't even solve his wife's murder. And now I live in a basement in return for offering security to a mate's garage. And the only way I can get through the day is with hard drugs. Pathetic, isn't it?
Jess is still holding onto his hand, and now she winds her fingers through his. She holds his hand up to her mouth, and he feels her kiss his fingers. Exactly the opposite, she whispers.
Chapter 48. He stands at the mirror, cleaning his teeth. So they've found his flat. He led them there. He knew it would happen. It's not a problem. But he's lost everything. His belongings, all his treats and souvenirs. So he'll need to make some more. The thought of it gets him excited. He's bold now. He's got away with so much and they know nothing. He thinks about what he'd like to do next. Bundy, maybe. The man was a fucking pioneer. Maybe he'd do something like the Chi Omega sorority murders. 4 women in one night, 2 of them dead, strangled, 1 fucked with an aerosol can. He even chewed off one of their nipples. Now there was a man who lost control. If Ted hadn't been so stupid as to bite one of their ass cheeks, maybe he'd still be around today. Maybe he'd still be killing. He spits out the toothpaste, rinses his mouth under the tap. He smiles. He'd never be that stupid. Only a few days to go now, and he still has so much to do. He remembers something he read about a man who killed his victims in front of a mirror, a cord around their necks, strangling, tightening, then releasing, letting them breathe for a moment, letting them live, then repeating it. Literally watching themselves die. He feels himself grow hard just thinking about it. What would that be like? Watching the pain and fear in a woman's eyes as he killed her over and over again, as she lost her grip on reality, then for her to regain consciousness, to find herself back where she started. He grips himself harder, faster, as the scenario plays out. Different women's faces flicker through. This seems too good for an unknown. One face sticks in his mind, someone familiar, and as he imagines her mouth, her eyes, her torture, everything he'll do to her, he comes, forcefully, ejaculating into the sink. Oh God, yes, he thinks, shuddering and breathless. He'll save this for her. Only her.
Day 7. Sunday. Chapter 49. I'm still waiting. I'm fucking fed up of waiting. It's an itch I can't scratch now. I know how it feels, like the best feeling of all. Nothing else will do. The porn doesn't work, not even the expensive stuff, not even the real ones where the bitch dies, where he fucks her to death. I want that to be me. It should be me. Now I know how easy it is. I want to go back and do it again. I want to stand in front of their dead, destroyed bodies, full of my cum, and fucking laugh. Laugh at the detectives who can't catch me, who don't have a fucking clue. Laugh as they go this way, then the other, following their leads that I put in front of them. I want to be Ted, fucking and biting. I want to be Raider, with his bondage and torture and killing. I want to be Shawcross and stuff leaves into those bitches' cunts when they're dead. Berkowitz shooting, shooting, shooting.
Gov?
Griffin calls from across the room, and Kara holds her hand up for a second. She's been sitting in her office, one of the many notebooks from flat 214 in her gloved hand. It's a cheap, A4, spiral-bound pad, lab-confirmed available from any Tesco throughout the country. But every page, every line is filled. Marks made in black biro, pushed hard onto the page, sometimes going through the paper. He doesn't use punctuation. There's no marking of time or date. Just hard capitals. An incoherent diatribe of darkness and death. She puts it back into its evidence bag, then pushes her fingertips into her eyes. Colours dance in the blackness as she rubs them. They feel scratchy and sore. She knows she's not getting enough sleep, and this stuff isn't helping. She carries it across to Shenton's desk. He looks up as she approaches and she hands it to him. "Might be worth you having a read of this," she says. He nods, then goes back to the screen. She wants to ask how he's getting on, but she doesn't want to pressurise him. Getting into this madman's head must be bad enough as it is. She leaves him to it and goes to where Griffin is sitting. She's still not sure how she feels about working with her brother. So far, he's been behaving himself. No warning flags. And it's been nice to see him every day, she has to admit that. Kara pulls a chair over and sits down at the desk. "Did you have any luck with social services?" she asks, referring to the line of inquiry tracking down the file connected to the video she's been looking at last night. They find the child on the tape, this Robbie. Maybe they have their killer. But he shakes his head.
"It's Sunday. I spoke to the woman on call. Everyone else is still in bed. She says all records from the year 1996 were paper-based, so they'd need to go to the storage facility and go through them by hand. And without a case number, that could take a while."
"Phone her back. We'll send a team down to help," she says, mentally adding it to the list. She turns her attention to his computer where he has CCTV on the screen. "Show me this first. From the bar?" she asks, and Griffin points to a lone figure. It's Libby. She's sitting on a high stool. Kara recognises the bar from the evening she spent there, but this time Libby is alone. She looks nervous, every now and then glancing to the door. They scroll through the footage. A few people approach her, but they leave after a brief interaction. "Where is he?" Kara asks.
"Never turns up," Griffin says. "She leaves after an hour. But watch."
On the screen, Libby finishes her drink and gets up, and Griffin switches the footage to the outside. A car pulls up, and Libby walks around to the driver's side window, leaning down and talking to the person inside. She smiles, and then gets in.
"That's Michael Sharp's car," Griffin says, "and the only view."
Kara notices Griffin seems quieter today. He's more subdued. His face is pale with more than a few days of stubble. She makes a mental note to get him alone at some point, check that he's okay. But then the rest of the team look like shit, too. The incident room is covered in discarded coffee cups and chocolate wrappers. The smell in the air echoes the cigarettes smoked, the showers missed. The lives on hold in search of this guy. "There's no other CCTV," Kara continues, "from any other clubs or bars."
"Not even a cash point nearby," Griffin says, grimly. "Same as with your Kemper footage. But it looks like she recognises him."
"Shit," Kara mutters. She looks at Griffin. He's deep in thought. "You have a theory?" she asks. He rubs his hands over his face.
So the lab results have nothing in the car except for trace from Libby and Michael Sharp, right?
Kara nods.
And hair, blood and water from Sharp in the boot,
he adds.
So our killer takes Sharp out of storage.
The chest freezer in flat 214?
Probably, yes. And places him in the boot to defrost. Arranges to meet Libby at the Orange Rooms as her date, but then doesn't show. Drives there, picks her up, takes her to Sultan's Hill.
Willingly or at gunpoint? Kara interrupts.
I think we have to assume willingly, because it's hard to control someone and drive at the same time.
So she knows him well?
Maybe. Then when they get there, Libby discovers the danger she's in and tries to run. Once she's dead, he takes the body out of the boot, stages his suicide, and pulls the trigger.
So how did he get home again? Kara asks. She misses this, playing devil's advocate with her brother, the sparring back and forth.
Same question as with the Kemper murders,
Griffin says without missing a beat.
He drove the victims out to the middle of nowhere then too. Planning in advance? Left a car there?
Or has an accomplice?
He doesn't strike me as the sort of killer who plays well with others,
Griffin says.
This level of control, of planning, my guess is he wouldn't like the unpredictability that having an accomplice would bring.
Maybe, Kara says. She looks up as Shenton comes over. He puts two pieces of paper in her hands. She starts reading. Griffin tries to look over her shoulder, curious. Shenton twitches from foot to foot. She puts the pages down and gives Shenton a smile. This is good, Toby. Nay, round everyone up into the conference room. Shenton gives her his usual deer-in-the-headlights stare. Griffin looks at her quizzically.
What for?
Kara stands. Shenton's going to give us the profile. Chapter 50. The entire team fills the conference room. Griffin goes to take a seat at the back, but reconsiders, wanting to give his hesitant protégé a bit of encouragement from the first few rows. Shenton stands hunched at the front, the omnipresent notepad gripped in his fingers. Kara holds her hands up and the room silences. Shenton clears his throat as Kara introduces the purpose of the meeting. I need you all to listen and give Toby your full attention, she continues. Whatever your views on profiling, she adds with a warning look to Griffin. Griffin frowns. That's not fair. He's not entirely against the work forensic psychologists do. It's not as if they're psychics, after all. Toby looks at the expectant faces around the room. He smiles nervously. Griffin can already see perspiration on his forehead. What's Kara thinking? He wonders. Shenton's not ready for something like this, master's degrees or not.
I have read all the case files, looked at the photographs, and there are a few things I think I can tell you about our killer,
Shenton begins. Jumped up little fuck, the detective mutters next to Griffin, and someone else snorts with laughter. Toby pauses amid the continual chatter in the room. Kara glares at the detectives talking and everyone shuts up, fidgeting in their seats. Shenton carries on.
He knows about forensics. He never leaves a trace behind. He knows our procedures inside and out, so he might have spent time in the police force or a related profession. He might even have inserted himself into the investigation somehow.
You're saying he's one of us? Someone shouts, and a burst of annoyance rings out.
I'm not saying he's a cop, Shenton stutters. Just someone close to law enforcement.
He clears his throat and looks down at his notes. Griffin sees his trademark blush start to creep up his neck.
We know he can drive and probably owns his own car. He pays rent on at least one property, so he's holding down a steady job. He is functioning in his everyday life.
More than some of the people in the room, Griffin thinks. His gaze drifts across to Deakin leaning against the wall on the opposite side. Griffin knows he looks like shit, but Noah takes home the award. Dark shadows under his eyes, skinnier than usual. It looks like he hasn't eaten for a week. Deakin catches his eye and glares back. Fucking Noah, Griffin thinks. Such an asshole. Meanwhile, Shenton is still talking.
We know he keeps souvenirs of his kills, the Polaroids,
and the fact he displayed them prominently shows us he is proud of what he has achieved. Some offenders show guilt or regret, using alcohol or food to cope, but this guy will not. He is actively enjoying seeing the result of his actions.
You think it's one guy? Someone shouts to Griffin's right.
We have no reason not to, so yes, probably one.
He's standing up straighter now, seemingly getting into his stride. Griffin feels a grudging pride for the kid, and respect for his sister. She'd obviously recognised the potential in Shenton before anyone else had.
But even if not, Toby continues, we're looking at one dominant and one submissive. One guy calling the shots.
And it's definitely a man.
A DC speaks up from the back.
Yes, definitely. And a heterosexual man at that.
But he's sodomised men,
the DC adds, and Shenton nods.
Yes, but the male rapes were functional, carried out methodically as his victims were dead or dying in order to fit the MO of Jeffrey Dahmer.
If you contrast them with the female rapes, Toby turns and picks up one of the crime scene photos from the GSK attacks.
They were violent and brutal, none more so than in the case of Mia Griffin.
Silence descends. Griffin feels his skin prickle as faces turn his way.
Fucking hell, Toby. Really? He thinks. You had to choose that example?
But he forces his expression to remain impassive, staring at the man at the front of the room.
I believe he holds a woman accountable for his problems and takes his rage out on women as a result. So it's unlikely he can hold down a normal relationship. He has an emotional need to degrade and destroy. He probably even has some sort of dysfunction, unable to maintain an erection without this sort of violence.
Shenton holds his head up high. He puts his notebook down to his side. His face is serious.
This is a man who wants his victims to suffer, he says. He derives sexual pleasure and satisfaction from hurting them, from the power he exerts over their lives and ultimately their deaths. He listens to their screams and gets off on their pain.
Shenton pauses. The room is completely silent. He has the undivided attention of every detective there.
He's a sexual sadist, and a dangerous one. Each kill only fuels the appetite for inflicting more pain, but he'll need to do more each time to get off. He'll become more elaborate, more personal. I am in no doubt that he will continue to kill, and he won't stop until we catch him.
He stops. The mood in the room has chilled.
Every detective knew the severity of the man they were trying to catch.
But little DC Toby Shenton has brought it home. Every word, pinpointing their failures. The unspoken truth is, if they don't catch him, the next murders are on them.
So who will he kill next? Who will he echo?
Shenton takes a deep breath.
I can't say, he says, and Griffin hears the disquiet. But his signature is interesting in itself.
His signature? Kara asks.
Toby turns to her.
The MO, modus operandi, is what our offender does to kill. It's the stabbing, the strangulation, the gunshot. And as we have seen, it changes. But the signature,
he smiles.
That's the interesting part. It's what the offender does to get himself off. It's influenced by the why, and it doesn't change.
So what about the Echo Man?
He's copying others. What does he get from it?
Shenton looks at the faces around the room, waiting for some sort of answer. Everyone stays quiet.
He's a sexual sadist. He could enjoy himself a lot more if he wasn't limited by the mimicry. So why do it? He asks again.
He can't think for himself,
a detective says from the back. Shenton shakes his head.
But we know he's clever. This guy's not lacking in originality.
Still silence.
I believe he's hiding behind it, enjoying pretending he's someone else. But it's more than that. He likes the notoriety of killers of the past, but he's enjoying beating them, exceeding their achievements, feeling like he's better than them. And as I mentioned before, I think it's about the power. He's taking back some of the control he's lost in the past,
maybe from the sexual abuse, exerting his authority over his victims. It's intoxicating to him.
So how do we catch him?
The question gets a wave of assent from the room. Griffin feels the energy mount. Shenton stops. His previous confidence has faded in the face of the whole room staring. Griffin knows this is the hard part. He needs to make a decision.
He's been killing for a long time, at least a few years.
He's staring at the floor, thinking out loud.
And his kills are getting more frequent. He's escalating. Where before he was patient, cleverly putting together the pieces of his puzzle.
His puzzle?
Griffin interrupts.
Yes, because I think this is what this is. Take the Dharma staging. That would have taken a long time to put together. That's a lot of bodies, a lot of killing. Plus Michael Sharp in the freezer. He must have killed him before he took over his flat, but yet he didn't dismember him like he did the others. He obviously had a plan, and that must have taken patience.
Shenton looks around the room at the expectant faces.
But now he's speeding up. More kills, less space between them. Something must have happened. An incident in his present day or a significant date linked to his past. And I think, by killing Libby, he's asking for attention. He wants to be seen.
Do you think he wants to be caught? Kara asks.
No. At least, not yet.
Shenton looks at her.
He's only leaving behind the evidence he wants us to find, like Michael Sharp's blood in the Kemper car, and the pint glass in his flat with Libby's fingerprints and DNA. I think he's enjoying the mess he's creating. He's a narcissist. He feels superior, entitled. He'll be enjoying the power, watching us run around after him.
Shenton's face colours, knowing he just criticised the investigation. But Kara shrugs it off.
So what do you suggest we do? She asks. I think we should hold a memorial for Libby, he says.
Go on.
We do it somewhere public. We make a big deal out of it. Ideally, it would be her funeral, but we won't have the body released for weeks yet, so let's do a memorial.
And what would be the point in that? Griffin asks. Taking advantage of her death. Her relatives will never agree.
They will if we explain why we're doing it.
Shenton's hands flutter excitedly.
Because he won't be able to resist the opportunity. He'll want to see the grief. He'll get a kick out of seeing the destruction he's caused. We hold a memorial, and I guarantee he'll show up.
You guarantee, huh? Kara says, and Shenton looks uncertain for a second, but then nods slowly. Well then, Kara stands up straight in front of the group. Let's do this. Let's get this organised. Chapter 51. Kara watches the detectives file out, back to the incident room. Shenton's the last to go, looking back at her as he follows his colleagues. Well done, Toby, she says, and she forces her warmest smile. Just shut the door on your way out. The moment the door clicks shut, Kara sags. She's alone in here. The blinds closed, and she slumps into a chair, putting her head into her hands. The enormity of the case is suddenly too much. Shenton's insecurities, her brother's dead wife, Noah's what? She can't put a label on it, but something certainly seems to be bothering him. As if reading her thoughts, there's a light knock on the door and Deacon pokes his head around.
What?
She snaps, more sharply than she intended.
We just need a few decisions about this memorial, he starts.
Then he tilts his head to one side, appraising her.
You okay?
She feels his dark eyes rest on her face. She goes to answer, but her throat tightens.
She can't remember the last time anyone asked if she was all right.
She swallows, but before she can protest, thick tears start to fall. She brushes them away, annoyed.
I'm sorry,
Kara manages to say. You aren't here for waterworks. He closes the door behind him and walks over to sit next to her.
You don't need to apologise, he says softly. This is a fucking shitty case, and you have the unlucky job of being SIO. It's not surprising you're feeling the stress.
She clears her throat again, looking up to try to dispel the tears. She'd never cry in front of the team, show her uncertainty or weakness. But Noah is different.
I'm just so fucking shattered. I haven't seen the kids properly for days.
So go home. Have a nap, he says.
But she's shaking her head even before he's finished talking.
You know I can't do that.
She laughs hollowly. Look around the office. Kara gestures towards the door, where she knows her detectives are hard at work on the other side. Nobody's had a break. Everyone's feeling the stress. I'm not quitting on them. I'm not quitting on the women, the men he's killed. He leans forward, closer to her,
and for a moment she thinks he's going to hold her hand.
But he moves backwards again, and a fleeting thought passes through her mind.
What would she have done if he had?
Next to her phone starts to buzz. She doesn't recognise the number, so she lets it ring out. She takes a deep breath, then remembers the box of evidence in her office.
And can you deal with those notebooks? Find a handwriting expert, something like that, see if they can shed any light.
He nods.
Business as usual, then, he says, with a half-hearted smile.
Business as usual, Deeks, she finishes, and the phone goes off again.
Oh, for fuck's sake, she mutters, and answers it.
DCI Elliot? This is Steve Gray, from the Chronicle.
Kara almost hangs up.
She hasn't got the time for this shit. How did you get my number? I haven't got anything to say about the case. Please speak to PR as usual.
No, DCI Elliot, wait. We've got something you need to see.
His tone makes her pause. He sounds panicked.
What? A letter. We've been sent a letter, he splutters. And we think it's from the killer.
Chapter 52. Kara and Deakin stand in the newspaper editor's office. The note is in front of them on the desk, now enclosed in a see-through plastic evidence bag. Nobody speaks. The journalist and his editor watch them. Steve Gray is short, blonde, thin. His editor the exact opposite, with a round, fleshy face and button eyes. They both seem unnerved, but annoyingly excited. The letter had arrived the day before in a plain white envelope, the address written on the front in blue felt tip. Please rush to editor, it says below the address. But it had been ignored until this morning when they had opened it, and a piece of black material had fluttered out.
Gave us a shock, I can tell you,
Gray had said, pointing to the fabric, still left on the desk where it had fallen. With a gloved hand, Kara had put it in another evidence bag. The note inside is written on a piece of white-lined paper in the same pen. Kara reads it again. This is the Echo Man speaking. I am the murderer of the couple over by Sultan's Hill last night. To prove it, here is a blood-stained piece of her dress. I am the same man who did in the people in the rest of the UK. I want you to print this cipher on the front page of your paper. In this cipher is my identity. If you do not print this cipher by the afternoon of Fry 5th of Feb, I will go on a kill rampage Fry night. I will cruise around all weekend, killing lone people in the night, then move on to kill again, until I end up with a dozen people over the weekend. At the bottom of the page is a circle with a cross through it, the mark of the Zodiac Killer.
What does Shenton say?
Deakin asks. The editor had already sent over a scanned copy of the message, giving their DC a head start on the analysis. He's confirmed the wording is almost precisely the same as notes from the Zodiac back in 1969, Kara replies. Two merged together, just the details relevant to our case changed.
And the...
newspaper editor pauses.
The code?
Attached to the note is another piece of paper. Across it are a number of symbols and letters. A cipher, in the same style as the Zodiac Killer.
That's different, Kara confirmed.
So it could be a new code, containing the identity of our guy?
Possibly.
They all fall silent again. Kara picks up the envelope. There are double the number of stamps needed for normal postage. all stuck on sideways. The postmark is the day before Libby's murder.
"So we'll be publishing this tomorrow,"
the editor says. Kara sighs. She knows better than to hope they'd keep it quiet. It was too much of a scoop.
"Can you just hold on to it for a day or two? You can still have the exclusive," she adds quickly. "But please give us a chance to solve it and catch the guy. You publish the identity of the killer and there's a chance he'll go to ground."
The editor frowns.
"You got 4 days," he points to the note. "I don't want it on my conscience if we don't publish this by Friday and he goes on this rampage he's talking about. And I want confirmation on whose dress this belongs to."
Kara feels a ripple of anger. That was her friend's dress. Her friend. Not some device to sell newspapers. But she nods. She needs to keep this guy on side.
"Thank you," she adds.
They take the original note, the code, and the piece of material with them, leaving a copy for the newspaper, and get in the car.
"Do you think this will tell us the killer's name?" Deakin asks. "It seems a bit easy."
"We haven't cracked it yet," Kara says. She still feels weary. The gravity of the case weighs on her mind. They start to drive, and as they head back towards town, Kara wants to see Rue. She wants a hug from her husband, from someone who can tell her it's all going to be okay.
"Do you mind if we stop by the restaurant?" she asks. Deakin seems reluctant, but does as she asks, pulling the car up outside.
"I'll get us some lunch while I'm here," she adds to appease him.
Kara gets out and looks through the huge plate glass windows. Service hasn't yet begun, and she opens the door, walking through the empty tables, laid up with white napkins and shining silver cutlery. Tables she knows will soon be filled with posh clientele, ladies who lunch, businessmen making the most of steaks on expenses. A few people working notice her and nod. They have a low staff turnover here, and most of them know her. And she goes through to the kitchen. Tempting smells are already coming from the many ovens. A few chefs finish up last-minute prep, but she can't see Rue. Then she spots him on the far side, standing at the open back door. He's smiling, talking to someone, and she takes a moment to admire him in his chef's whites. He's good-looking, in better shape than most men his age, tall, greying, with a smile that pulls people towards him. She's seen the appreciative scrutiny from women in Waitrose. She notices his shoes. Converse trainers, the same brand as the footwear marks found outside Griffin's bathroom window when he was attacked, also identified by the witness on the man going into flat 214. Seeing them on her husband's feet just confirms what she knew already. Millions of men wear those sneakers. The results don't narrow their suspect pool down. Kara goes to say hello, but hesitates as she sees who he's talking to. He's laughing, and reaches out a hand to touch her arm. A woman with long blonde hair, parted in the middle. It's Lauren. Kara watches her smile back and she frowns. But then she stops herself. Bloody Deeks and his theories, she curses, making her paranoid. She's probably just dropping something off for the kids or meeting someone for lunch. But deep down she knows this place is too expensive for Lauren. And she's never known her come here before. Then Rue leans forward. He puts a hand on Lauren's waist and kisses her. It's on her cheek, not her lips, or a full-blown snog, but something about it. The slowness, the smile, something tells Kara it's not innocent. Kara steps away from the kitchen, then hurries through the restaurant. She feels the curious glances from the waiting staff, but she doesn't stop until she's back in the car. "Just drive," she instructs Noah, and he gives her a puzzled look. "And give me that," she adds, referring to the cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He passes it across without a word, and she takes a long drag. It makes her feel dizzy, but she needs it. She stares resolutely out of the window, letting the car fill with smoke, making her eyes water. She feels Deakin glance across to her, but she's embarrassed. She can't bring herself to say anything out loud, to acknowledge her failures. A serial killer she can't catch, mocking her day after day. and a husband cheating on her with the nanny.
Chapter 53. All eyes are on Kara and Deakin as they arrive back in the office. They'd tried hard to keep the note and the cipher quiet, but news had spread rapidly around the team, and now everyone wants a piece of the action. Griffin knows it's just eagerness to latch onto a new lead, to get the case solved. But he snaps at a few of the younger DCs as their enthusiasm creeps into callousness. Kara allocates tasks across the office, rushing the piece of material and the letter to the lab, making copies of the code, trying to find someone who might be able to crack it. A few arrogant DCs take a print themselves, keen to take the glory. Kara goes back to her office. She's been businesslike, the DCI in charge. But to Griffin, she seems off. He's known her long enough to sense when she's hiding something. He leans in the doorway of her office. He waits until she looks at him. "What do you want?" she asks abruptly.
"What are you not telling us?"
Kara stares at him for a moment, then she asks,
"You got any cigarettes?"
He nods and follows her to the roof. Griffin knows they're not allowed up here, but he assumes that a DCI and a DS will get away with it. Kara props the fire door open and they lean against a wall, sheltering away from the wind. He hands her a cigarette and she takes it, cupping her hand around the delicate flame of his lighter.
"Since when did you start smoking again?"
he asks, doing the same. "Since a maniac killer started conducting mass murder under my nose."
"Serial murder, not mass murder,"
Griffin smiles.
"Or you'll have Shenton correcting you."
She makes a noise halfway between a laugh and a snort. "You be nice to Shenton," she scolds. "He's trying his best."
"You always did have a soft spot for nerds."
Griffin watches her as she takes another drag.
"What's going on, Kara?"
She breathes in deeply and lets it out in a series of juddering sighs.
"Rue's cheating on me,"
she says in almost a whisper. Griffin's hands form into fists.
"Oh, kill him," he growls.
"Not before I do."
But then Kara's face crumples and she starts to cry, and Griffin pulls her close in a hug. He scowls, resting his face on the top of her head.
He's always liked Rue, but this
he can't forgive.
"How do you know?"
he asks after a moment.
"Who with?"
Kara pulls away from him and looks at her cigarette, burning down to the filter.
"Deeks and I went to the restaurant on the way home and I saw them together. Him and Lauren."
"Your nanny? Oh, Jesus, what a fucking cliché."
"I know," Kara almost laughs through her tears. "I feel so stupid. What have they been doing behind my back? At the house when I've worked late? Some sodding detective I am."
She looks up at Griffin.
"No, a guest, you know."
Griffin raises his eyebrows. Perhaps he doesn't give Deacon enough credit as a detective. And as a friend. He feels shit. He should have been there for her. He should have noticed.
"How did it get to be like this, Nate?" she asks him.
Kara leans back against the concrete wall and takes another drag of her cigarette. Her hair has escaped and is frizzy around her face. In that moment, she reminds Griffin of a Kara at 17, smoking around the back of school, waiting for their mum to pick them up. Kara's still talking.
"You get married and you think, that's it now, sorted. And then look what happens."
She stops herself.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to compare Rue with what happened to Mia."
Griffin shakes his head.
"I know what you mean. You just can't anticipate this shit."
He finishes his cigarette and crushes it underfoot.
"What are you going to do now?"
"With Rue?"
Kara shrugs. She does the same with her butt.
"Not a clue."
"You'll figure it out."
Kara looks up at him and he chuckles.
"Do you remember when we were about 12 or 13? We were on holiday playing table tennis."
"Remember? I still have the scar."
Kara leans forward into the light, and Griffin can just make out a small pale line on her cheekbone.
"That's not it."
"That is," Kara laughs. "After all this time, you could have taken my eye out."
Griffin stops, stunned. He remembers the incident, normal sibling rivalry.
Kara winning game after game on the uneven table tennis table until Griffin lost his temper, throwing his bat. It took a chunk out of her face, blood everywhere, their parents furious and forcing him to apologise. Unrepentant, he stormed out, only returning hours later once it was dark. And still he refused to say sorry. Kara stayed silent and magnanimous until the final day of the holiday, when a stomach complaint forced him into the toilet, missing the big trip to the water park. Kara returned, skin tanned, wet and exhausted, laughing with her new friends. He was lying on his bed in the dark, miserable and jealous, when she'd come into the room.
"How are you feeling?" she'd asked.
"Awful."
"You deserve it," she'd said, and he'd stared at her, disbelieving. "You should have said sorry."
Kara looks at him now in the half-light of the roof.
"What do you suggest I do? Put laxative in Rue's milkshake?" Griffin laughs. "No, but you were always the calculated one, even then. I react."
He points a finger at her.
"You think. You'll figure it out," he repeats,
and she smiles. Then her face turns serious.
"Nate, this woman, this murder suspect, you need to bring her in."
Griffin stays silent. He knows that Kara's right. He's getting himself in trouble. And Kara, too.
"You haven't found anything definitive on the arson, have you?" she continues. He slowly shakes his head.
"So we need to deal with it the proper way. Legally," she adds.
"Give me a bit longer," he pleads. "And if I don't find anything, I'll arrest her myself."
But he knows he won't. He could never put cuffs on her wrists, see the look of betrayal on her face. He tells himself it's because she's innocent, that it would be a miscarriage of justice, leaving her to the fate of Taylor's shoddy investigation. But in his heart, he knows it's something else. A part of him that doesn't want her to leave. Kara gives him a hard stare. "Fine." She goes to say something else, but her phone buzzes and she looks at it. "That's Noah. Says he's found a cryptographer or whatever these people are called. Let's hope they can solve this bloody code." Griffin nods and they head back in. As they go down the stairs, he adds,
"Office still open."
Kara stops and looks at him.
"With Rue? I don't have to break any bones. Just rough him up a bit."
Kara sniggers and Griffin smiles. At least that's one thing good, he thinks to himself. At least he can still make his big sister laugh.
Chapter 54.
"This is interesting. Very interesting," Professor Barnett says, his attention focused on the piece of paper on his desk. He has a look on his face usually reserved for small children at Christmas time. Deakin has already sent him a copy of the message, but they'd brought the original along in case it offered anything else in the way of clues.
"But can you work out the code?" Kara asks, impatiently. The professor's abundant set of eyebrows dance as he chuckles.
"This isn't a code. It's a cipher, where each letter is substituted for another, or a symbol in this case. Does it translate across to the zodiac ciphers that do have a solution?"
Kara shakes her head. They know that the first cipher received from the Zodiac Killer back in 1969 had been solved, by a teacher and his wife, no less, but none of the letters match up. Same with the one cracked years later, in 2020.
"Sadly not," she says. "Do you think you can do this one?"
"I'll certainly try," Professor Barnett replies. "Ciphers like this can be solved using certain rules from our day-to-day language. For example, E is the most common letter, followed by T, A, O, and N. Some letters often appear doubled, like E and L, and some letters often occur together. We can apply these rules to the symbols to try to work out the substitution. For example, we might be able to guess that the word kill appears in the text, like it did in the original."
"Seems simple enough," Deakin says, but the professor laughs.
"That all assumes your guy has done a simple substitution, but given the subject matter and what's at stake, he's probably included some random stuff in there to throw us off. And because of the way it's written, you have no idea where the words start or end. I'm also guessing it's a homophonic cipher using multiple substitutions for a single letter. He stops and rubs his hands together. He looks happy. We'll have some fun in the meantime, and I'll see if any of my colleagues at GCHQ want to have a go, as long as that's okay.
Kara agrees, and she and Deacon leave, taking the original letter with them.
Well, we've made his day, at least, Deacon says. Perhaps we should publish it in the newspaper. Let the general public have a go.
And then what? Put the solution on Twitter? What if they get it wrong and start a lynch mob, Deeks? As they walk through the campus of the university, Kara looks at the other people there, the students, lecturers, going about their normal lives. She envies their ignorance, their ability to carry on, not knowing that someone might murder and torture them tonight. It could be the person walking at their side, and they'd never know. She sighs, and Deacon glances at her.
What happened earlier? He asks. At the restaurant?
Kara can't look at him.
Let's just say you were right, she mutters. Ah.
Deacon falls silent.
And did Griffin have anything useful to say on the subject?
He offered to beat him up.
His usual way of solving problems, then.
They get to the car, and Kara looks at Deacon over the roof. I know you two don't get along, but if one of you just made the effort, you might realise you're more alike than you know. Deacon shakes his head as he gets into the passenger seat.
I think that's unlikely, Kara. I just can't stand the way he is. Like he thinks normal rules don't apply to him. The rest of us have to follow procedure, and that's how we get convictions. Why should he get a free pass?
Well, will you just please try, she begs. For me. Deacon sighs.
Anything for you, Kara. You know that.
They both sit in Kara's car. She knows neither of them wants to head to the station, back to nagging the lab, chasing Ross for more post-mortem results, to crossing their fingers and hoping they get something they can work with. They need this time, this space, even if it's just for the moment. Kara reaches across Noah and opens the glove box, finding two flapjacks left for the kids one time. She's not sure how old they are, but passes one to Deacon and he opens it. She eats her own, enjoying the abrupt sweetness. Have you ever thought you could kill someone? The words come out before she's thought about them. She glances anxiously to Noah, but he's not judging. He takes another bite of his flapjack and chews thoughtfully.
I'd like to think I couldn't, but if it came down to it, maybe. Yes. If my life was in danger, something like that.
Is that the line for you? Someone threatening your life?
Or someone I loved.
Kara wonders who that is for Noah. Did you have to do anything like that for SO10? She asks.
What, kill someone? Deacon asks.
She nods.
No. It was usually me getting beaten up. And stabbed once.
Really?
Yeah, here.
Noah takes his coat off, Rue's raincoat, and throws it on the back seat, then pulls up the edge of his shirt. Kara peers at the small, jagged scar down the side of his stomach, then gets distracted by the line of dark hair disappearing into the waistband of his jeans. She looks away quickly. Did it hurt?
Nah, he grins, pulling his shirt back down. What about you? Who would you kill?
Kara thinks about her family. I'd kill this guy, she says, almost whispering, for what he did to Libby, and Mia and Griffin.
How?
How? Kara hadn't thought about it in that way. How much pain would she inflict? Would she want this guy to suffer? Perhaps something quick, she mutters. Gun, poison, plastic bag over the head, something like that.
Could you, though? Deacon asks. If someone gave you a gun, could you pull the trigger?
He pauses.
And you trust Griffin?
Nate! To have my back, yes, Kara replies, without hesitation. Noah shakes his head.
That's not what I mean. In the face of the man who murdered his wife, do you trust him not to kill him? We've both seen what he did to Mia and to him. It's a big ask. That faced with your wife's rapist and killer, you won't do the same to them.
Kara chews her lip.
Could you honestly say you'd arrest the guy if you were Griffin? Walk away? If you had the power in your very sizable hands? You know it, Kara. He could easily kill, without breaking a sweat.
Kara goes to defend her brother, but she knows Noah's right. Griffin has a temper and biceps to match. It wouldn't take much. A few well-aimed punches to the guy's face and it would be game over. Griffin's life, his career, would be finished.
I won't let that happen, she says at last.
Deacon seems to take her word for it. Or even if he doesn't believe her, he has the good grace to let it go. He looks at the last bit of flapjack in his hand.
I think these are stale, Kara.
He looks at her with a small smile.
Is this your plan? To do me in with dodgy baked goods?
Her phone rings, interrupting their conversation, and she sees Marsh's number. She answers it as Deakin shrugs and eats the last piece.
Where are you, Elliot?
On our way back to the station, Gov.
Come and see me when you get back. Straight away.
He hangs up without any pleasantries. Kara has a sinking feeling.
Marsh wants to see me.
Can't be good, Deakin comments. No, she replies. Not at all. Her hunch is confirmed the moment Kara sees the Detective Chief Superintendent's face.
Sit down, he instructs. Where are we?
Kara doesn't need to ask what he's referring to. She gives a rundown on every lead they have followed up, every piece of evidence. It doesn't take long.
So you have nothing, basically, except a code nobody can break, shoe marks from one of the most common brands of trainers, a case file from 1996 that you can't find, a bit of greenery from a bog, and a queue of bodies stacking up in the mortuary.
We're tracking down every single piece of CCTV, testing swabs, taking fingerprints, samples. But nothing comes up. He's smart, Gov. He must be using condoms for the rapes. He knows where the cameras are. He knows how to avoid leaving anything forensics can work with.
And don't I know it, Marsh mutters. Have you seen my budget?
He doesn't wait for Kara to answer.
I'm getting pressure, DCI Elliot. Questions are being asked from above. About you. About the competency of my SIO to lead this case.
Kara feels her stomach drop.
We need results, and we need them soon, before any more bodies turn up. They're talking about mentioning it at PM's question time, do you know that, Elliot? They're going to ask the fucking Prime Minister why the biggest case in UK history isn't being handled by the Met.
Put anyone else as SIO, sir, and I assure you they'll have the same results.
That may be true, but we need to be seen to be doing everything we possibly can.
He pauses.
You have this memorial tomorrow, right? He asks.
Kara nods.
You have 24 hours after that. Then we're handing it over.
Kara walks out of his office and goes quickly down the stairs, pushing open the door to the toilets. She goes into one of the cubicles, puts the seat down and sits on it, putting her head between her knees, her hands on her head. She doesn't blame Marsh. She feels how badly the investigation is going. She knows how little they have to go on. The memorial tomorrow is their one shot in the dark, their Hail Mary that the guy's ego won't be able to resist and he'll show up. But then what? How will they know? Half of her feels like she doesn't care anymore. She's barely eaten a hot meal in days. She hasn't had more than 8 hours sleep across the whole week combined. She's at home so rarely that her husband is shagging the nanny. It's not healthy. She wonders whether she should just pack it in. Put everything in boxes and pass it across to the Metropolitan Police or the National Crime Agency to worry about. Then she can go home. Have a bath. Watch the latest series of The Crown on Netflix. Kara hears someone else come into the bathroom, closing the door to another cubicle. She realises how ridiculous she's being, sitting here listening to someone else's bodily functions. This isn't her, this defeat, this giving up. This man has raped 8 women, killed 13. He has chopped up 11 men and put them in his freezer. She mentally counts up the dead. It's 28 in total, not counting Taylor's arson. She can barely believe the number. It seems so ridiculous. She leaves the cubicle and washes her hands. She stands in front of the mirror. I'm damn well going to catch him, she resolves. Even if it destroys my entire life in the process. Chapter 55.